The reading is from Habakkuk chapter 1, beginning in verse 1 and finishing at chapter 2, verse 1. And in the Black Church Bibles, it's on page 662. Habakkuk chapter 1. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people, who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves, and promote their own honour. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong, their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture, swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own strength is their god. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have deigned them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint.
Let's open our Bible, shall we? Page 663 in the Church Bible, the prophecy of Habakkuk. We're pressing, obviously, the pause button on our main Sunday morning series this term, Reclaiming Church, to breathe the very different air of this Old Testament prophecy. His name, Habakkuk, means the one who struggles. And that's a pretty good summary of the message of the book, for Habakkuk is unique among the prophets. He addresses a lament to God rather than to Israel, because just like so many of us, Habakkuk struggles to make sense of what God is doing. It can be a relief sometimes to know that we are not the only ones who look at the confusion and chaos with which we live and cry out, as the prophet does there in verse 2. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save. Take a tsunami or the sudden terminal cancer of a close relative. Take human trafficking. The fact that a billion people don't have access to safe drinking water. We're going to struggle to reconcile the truth of an all-good and all-powerful God with the disproportionate suffering of some in our world. Perhaps the reflections of Holocaust survivor Eli Wiesel are among the most poignant. All the Jews in his village were herded together, stripped of their possessions and loaded into those cattle carts. The first night Wiesel's train pulled up at Birkenau, coils of ominous black smoke billowed into the sky, and he was later to write, "Never shall I forget that night. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust." Wiesel saw his mother, a younger sister, and eventually his entire family forced into the extermination ovens. His memoirs explore what happens to faith when faced by the apparent silence of God in places like a concentration camp. So here this morning is another Jew, Habakkuk, who lived in the second half of the 7th century BC, asking similar questions about the moral purpose of God in history. That is the focus, in fact, of Habakkuk's lament. He looks at the big picture of history, of nations and large-scale events as they impact upon Israel. Just as we might reflect today upon the rise of Islam in Western Europe and the aggressive tide of secularism in the UK and wonder, what does all this mean for the future of the church and Christianity in the land? It's what I like to call having a Google Earth perspective of faith. If you've got a mobile phone with that particular rather smart application, you know what I mean. With the Google Earth application, I can key in my house address, and I can see the small details of my little plot of land, and then I can zoom out across Cardiff and Wales and the world and see one Pantouin in context. Sometimes we can reduce the scope of Christian faith to little more than our own personal salvation, to my house and my life. But the Bible puts that issue of your salvation into a much larger context. For ultimately, the message of the Bible concerns the whole world and its destiny. The beginning is creation, and the end is the recreation of the heavens and the earth. And right at the heart of this wide canvas is the church, the community of faith. We are central to the plans and purposes of God in history. So when the sea of faith retreats and the church appears at best an irrelevance and at worst a laughingstock, we inevitably struggle to make sense of what this means for the plan of God. And what I hope we'll see this morning, and when we pick up the rest of the book in a couple of weeks' time, is that Habakkuk comes to some staggering conclusions. But let's start first with his complaints, what I'm calling the prophet's accusations in verses 1 to 4. In verse 2, God is charged with indifference. "How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you don't save?" God is being charged, accused, of indifference. The God of Israel, aware of the unraveling of Jewish society and the decline of Israel's faith, appears unconcerned. Unlike the prophet, who 6 times will rail against the violence and the destruction of the nation's spiritual life. It is perhaps the indifference of God, apparently, to the church and to the Christian heritage in the UK, which stirs many of us so deeply. Why does God permit the national church to be overrun by people who seem to play fast and loose with Scripture? Does God have no concern for the anti-Christian bias gaining ground in our society. Let me quote Dr. Taj Harge, Imam of the Oxford Islamic Congregation. It comes in a stimulating booklet by Patrick Sukdeo called The Way Ahead, Returning Britain to Its Christian Path. The Imam says, Christianity is under siege in this country. Britain's national religion has never been so marginalized and derided by the public institutions that should be defending it. And so the question is provoked. Why has God not answered the prayers of his faithful people for a renewal of his truth in this generation of ours? Why is the church in decline and God not intervene to arrest it? Why, Lord? And similar questions are asked by those who confront the apparent silence of God in their personal circumstances. Where is God when it hurts? Where was God when my husband had an affair? When my best friend got cancer? I was struck by the following account of a troubled New York firefighter as he talked to a psychotherapist about his experiences. 3 years ago, there was a fire, 6 stories up, 1-bedroom apartment, 15 people living in it. And I find a little girl, hurt pretty bad, holding a kitten. So I bring her down 6 stories. She's crying at me the whole time, saying, please, Mr. Fireman, please save my kitten. Please don't let anything happen to my kitten, Mr. Fireman. Anyway, long story short, cat lived. She didn't. 9/11, we lost 4 guys from this fire department. One of them was my cousin Jimmy. He stopped speaking for a few seconds. My best friend, best fireman I ever worked with, good family man, dedicated American. And every day I got to drive to work. I drive through my neighborhood. I see guys, drunken fools, that I went to school with. They're standing on the corner, high, having a great time. And I got to wonder why these idiots are still walking around when Jimmy Keefe ain't. Another long pause. My cousin the priest says, it's because it's all part of God's plan. You know what? If there is a God, he's got a whole lot of explaining to do. He said, that need for an explanation runs very deep in all of us. But the prophet brings a second charge against God. There in verses 3 and 4, he is inactive. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. God, you're doing nothing. You see, it's not just the brutality of the culture that appalls him. It's the corruption of the judicial system. The erasing of moral boundaries. The abuse of power. The devaluing of life. He's gone to God about these things on a regular basis and pleaded with him to do something. But nothing has changed. The poor continue to be exploited. It wasn't safe to walk the streets. And the legal process? Well, that appeared, like God, to be paralyzed too. You know, when you live in a culture like ours today, where a footballer can be paid in excess of £200,000 a week, while the poorest face eviction from their homes in the inner cities because of the impact of the public spending review, there is something wrong. It's insane. And it's that sense of frustration that perhaps we can relate to. Mark Riddle, writing in Third Way, puts it like this: you want justice? You want someone to admit responsibility? You want someone to stand up for the weak? All you get is bureaucracy. Oh, I've done my best to be civil. I've drawn deep breaths. I've filled in forms and produced documents. I've called on a friendly MP. Then I got angry. I shouted and became difficult. Now I am plotting imaginary massacres. But the officials still smile as they reach for the regulations book. But before we get to the third accusation the prophet levels against God from verse 12, we need to hear how God responds to the first two complaints. So 5 to 11, after the prophet's accusations, let's look at the Lord's answers. Verse 5, God says to the prophet, "Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed." Habakkuk will be baffled completely by the way God is going to operate. But one thing he needs to know is that God has never been asleep or detached, as he may have imagined. We are not to mistake in life God's silence for indifference or inaction. History is under his control. Look at the nations. They rise and fall at his command. In just the same way that the details of our lives are known and matter to a sovereign God who wants us to trust him as our Heavenly Father. So God tells Habakkuk, "You are not going to be able to make sense of what I am doing." And when God says in verse 6, "I am raising up the Babylonians," Habakkuk must have been wide-eyed, because at the time, the Babylonians were an insignificant nation under the shadow of the mighty Assyrians. Who would have thought that they would take center stage and become important in God's purposes? And secondly, the surprise was because the Babylonians were a morally bankrupt society, as God recognizes in the second part of verse 6. "I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own." So here's poor Habakkuk, already stressed that God was apparently doing nothing about the spiritual state of Israel, now overwhelmed by the news that God is going to use this utterly pagan empire to conquer Judah and judge God's own people. This nation, as God reminds his mystified servant in verse 10, this nation that was infamous for its psychological siege warfare, they will become the political masters of Israel. Those who, verse 10, deride kings and scoff at rulers, who laugh at all fortified cities, who build earthen ramps and capture them. They sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own strength is their God. No wonder the prophet says, "What are you doing, Lord?" There is a truth about God which human beings will often find difficult. His ways are not ours, nor are his thoughts. They are beyond us. So there will always be, friends, mystery in our world. Of course, the microchip subatomic age wants to outlaw the notion of mystery, to declare unacceptable the idea of unresolved data. Everything has to be taken apart and reduced and analyzed and classified and labeled and understood. And we demand the same deconstruction of God. We want God to function in a way we can predict and cope with, even control. We must have an explanation nailed down, neat and tidy. Of course, the best example in the Bible of this wrestling with the mystery of God is the story of Job's suffering. Remember how it happens in the space of 24 hours? He loses everything. And then for 37 chapters, God says nothing. God is silent until he finally speaks out of the hurricane. And what Job gets there is a series of observations and a whistle-stop tour of God's power as creator and sustainer. And these questions: where were you, Job, when I laid the earth's foundation? Have you ever given orders to the morning sun? Do you send lightning bolts on their way? Do they report back to you, Job? Is he like Job? We have our questions regarding life and its unresolved aches, its unsatisfied longings. But like Job, to meet God is not to get answers to our questions. It's to learn the right questions. We are like people looking through a kind of tiny keyhole, trying to make sense of what we can see in the room behind the closed door. The evidence is incomplete, and yet the temptation as we look through the keyhole is to draw conclusions which are as grand as they are false. There are times when we see glimpses of God's way, but not enough to make complete sense of what he's doing and why. But we can't resist this keyhole theology, jumping to conclusions regardless. So here's Habakkuk, looking through the keyhole, and he has his questions. But the answers he receives are even more difficult to understand, and they raise even more questions about God. The shell-shocked prophet goes to God again at verse 12. But this time, Habakkuk applies what he knows about God to the problems he's facing. Now, I suggest that is a very helpful and safe method of dealing with life from the perspective of faith. Apply what you know of God's character and truth to the issues that perplex you. You see, everything Habakkuk believed seemed to be contradicted by God's indifference and inaction. And now the news that God intended to use the Babylonians to accomplish his purposes of judgment against Israel, well, that's even more shocking. How is the prophet going to square the circle? So we come, finally, to the prophet's applications, 12 to 17. Application 1, verse 12, God is eternal. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? This was bedrock truth. For a moment, the prophet forgets his troubles and reminds himself that in contrast to the manufactured gods of the nations around, the God of Israel has no beginning or ending. He is self-existent. He is not dependent on anything or anyone. He is without cause, outside the flux of history. His throne reigns above the world. He is the ageless one, his kingdom like his power unrivaled. So whatever is happening, God is still king. The prophet, though, makes another application. God is holy. You see the next part of verse 12, my God, my holy one. His God is utterly committed to righteousness. He's absolutely pure. God is light. And there is no dark side to his character. He cannot be invaded or seduced by evil. As Habakkuk notes in verse 13, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. But this very fact creates the question of the rest of verse 13. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? It is the age-old question. An all-powerful God would be able to end suffering, and an all-loving God would desire to end suffering. But suffering exists. So, an all-powerful, an all-loving God does not exist. However, Habakkuk finds a different faith-inspired answer to that philosophical conundrum. God is faithful. That's his third application. Look at the phrase at the end of verse 12. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. God's people will not be abandoned. God's promises will be kept and his purposes fulfilled, even in judgment. So the rest of verse 12, O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. God is going to use the Babylonians, evil though they were, to achieve his greater purposes in the world for Israel. God will be true to himself, faithful and loving in all he does. That was Habakkuk's confidence as he applied what he knew about God to the situation he was facing. So come back to our equation. An all-powerful God exists. An all-loving God exists. Yes, suffering exists. Conclusion? God must have loving reasons for permitting suffering. Now, of course, that equation doesn't deal with the deep and mysterious issue of our personal suffering. It doesn't even come close. I'm aware of that. But what suffering in the world presents is not so much an intellectual dilemma for faith in God, but an emotional one. The real question that we've got, Habakkuk and us, the thing that we battle with is not, could God coexist with a suffering world? But why would God allow it? And that is the position that Habakkuk comes to by the beginning of chapter 2. Having wrestled in the verses just before with why God could create a world in which men are like fish in the sea that the wicked catch and destroy, he says there, in verse 1 of chapter 2, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. You see, he's looking through the keyhole, trying to make sense of what is going on around him. But he's decided to do one crucial thing. He suspends judgment. He will watch and wait. He won't jump to conclusions. And that's where I want to finish this morning. When faced by doubt or despair, when the clouds of disappointment roll in, when the ache does not go, and God seems to have been eclipsed by the awful realities around, how do we respond? We watch and wait. So here's my takeaway application. Suspend judgment, not thinking. What does it mean for faith to suspend judgment? Could this be a form of irrationality? Perhaps wrestling with doubt is a problem of too much thinking. After all, absolutely, emphatically, no, it is not. Most doubts have more to do with wrong thinking or no thinking at all than with too much thinking. No, we must go to God with the problems and leave them with him to watch and wait. This is what it means to live by faith. Now, that, of course, is one of the most famous expressions in the entire prophecy of Habakkuk. It occurs just a few verses after ours this morning, there in verse 4. But the righteous will live by his faith. I'm not going to, therefore, develop that verse now, beyond saying this. To suspend judgment and wait on God is a feature of living by faith, of trusting God with the issue. Now, it's something I confess I find terribly hard to do. I want resolution instantly. I want answers now. I want to move on to the next challenge. I don't like this sense of vulnerability, of waiting in the silence for God, of not knowing, of things feeling out of control. And then some of us perhaps go to God with the issue. We confess it to him. We open it up. We acknowledge the struggle and ask him to take it away. And then the moment we get up from our knees or whatever, we take it back. We don't leave it there with God. We begin to wrestle with the problem again. Listen to the advice of the prophet I will stand at my watch. I will look to see what he will say to me. What does God say to Habakkuk? Well, you'll have to come back in 3 weeks' time to find out. But for now, listen to the conclusion from another Jewish prisoner of war. And imagine all that lies behind these words as he wrestles with the issues of his world. I believe in the sun, even when it's not shining. I believe in love, even when I cannot feel it. I believe in God, even when he is silent. I was very, very moved by a story I heard this week about James Harvey, the senior pastor of a church in Newark, Delaware. His second son, Jacob, was born with cystic fibrosis, and those with some awareness of the condition know that, as with all special needs children, life can be marked by exhausting weeks of worry and hospital routines. And with a disease like cystic fibrosis, James and his wife, Melody, faced the real possibility of having to look their six-year-old in the eye and talk about heaven and dying and trusting Jesus. His dad, James Harvey, reflected on what he'd learned about those terrible days and said, "Sometimes God trains his servants by breaking their hearts." 2 years ago, his wife, Melody, in her mid-30s, was diagnosed with RSD, a disease in which the nervous system sort of overreacts to external stimulation. This meant that as her condition worsened, the slightest handshake, hug from her now four children, or even a strong breeze would leave her body racked with pain for days. So to save her life meant a costly, week-long, medically-induced coma in Monterrey, Mexico. That expensive procedure took place just a few months ago in August. And her recovery was going well until a new injury required her to receive another treatment. And that may mean another coma in Mexico. A member of James Harvey's congregation had this to say about what he had witnessed over the months and years. "Christ has been formed in our pastor and his family. Christ's sovereignty exalted in his preaching and teaching, which did not suffer the least, no matter how great his personal pain and suffering. Christ sustaining his broken-hearted servants in his word, by his spirit. We've seen a pastor and his family whose hope is rooted firmly in glory, not in the world. I have no doubt," says the member of the congregation, "that there are dark, how long, O Lord, moments, days, and seasons. I have no doubt that they have prayed fervently for relief and for restored joy in the midst of debilitating pain. I also have no doubt, none of us does, that they are leaning on the everlasting arms of their Heavenly Father, entrusting themselves to his goodness and care." You see, sometimes God trains his servants by breaking their hearts. That's what Habakkuk discovers. Why this should be, why the things that hurt us instruct, I do not know. But what I guess we all know is that the God who trains his servants by breaking their hearts sometimes is the God whose own heart was broken, whose own son died, the God who through Christ entered into the mystery of suffering on the cross so that we might have ultimate answers to our fears and pain and struggle, so that we might be able to look at the chaos, face the ache of our disappointed longings, and say, "It is well. It is well with my soul." The author of our final hymn this morning, Horatius Spafford, he discovered that. Some of you may know the story. His only son died at the age of four. Then in 1873, Spafford planned to travel to Europe with his family, but sent them on ahead while he was delayed on business in Chicago. And while crossing, the ship sank rapidly after a collision, and all four of Spafford's daughters died. His wife, Anna, survived and sent him the now famous telegram, "Saved alone." Shortly afterwards, as Spafford travelled to meet his grieving wife, he was inspired to write these words that we're going to sing together now. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to know, it is well with my soul."